You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Yesterday on Peace Watch, correspondent Eddie Becker reported from the Special Operations Command Symposium and Exhibition in Washington, D.C., sponsored by the Defense Industry Association. He's been learning military acronyms and reviewing the latest in whiz-bang warfighting technology. In tonight's segment, he learns about defense budgeting sleights of hand and mind-reading technology and guns that fire cluster bullets.
SOCOM stands for the Special Operations Command, and since 1987 includes all the covert, unconventional fighting forces like the Green Berets, Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, as well as secret components from the Central Intelligence and National Security Agencies. Over the years, they have been tasked not only to fight wars, but keep the peace, provide humanitarian assistance, infrastructure support, do psychological operations, and interdict drugs. Now, with a renewed mandate, they look to the future with greater commitment.
We are entering a phase now in the global war of terrorism, which will be just like the Cold War. You need to prepare yourself psychologically to fight terrorism for the next 50 years.
That was Tom Custer, who's the principal director for Special Operations at Combating Terrorism. In the office of the Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict, SOLIC, SOCOM, whatever. Now, these guys have real power and influence in the Department of Defense. They have as much, if not more, power than the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy. So they're pretty significant. Custer is the operational guy on the totem pole. It's his Department of Defense agency, the Special Operations Command for Low-Intensity Conflict, the SOLIC, which is spearheading the war on terrorism, or whatever or whoever they define as the enemy. He explains how in the Department of Defense, controlling the money is really how you wield power, and how the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict, or what you'll hear as ASD SOLIC, can redefine their mission to spend the money where they think it's most useful.
Follow the dollars. He who controls the dollars controls the door. And here we have the ASD SOLIC with humanitarian activities, civil response. We have them controlling the money. We're participating with SOCOM and MFP 11 battles. He's got the drug money coming through. So in terms of what can SOLIC do, we can leverage those types of money to help SOCOM fight the global war on terrorism. One of the things that has just occurred, and it happened without a lot of press play, and everybody on our side was really happy. For about 12 years now, the money that's been coming into the Department of Defense for narcotics has had about 7 million rules attached to it as to what you could use it for. But we realize that the limitations are really based upon what is your definition of counter-narcotics. So we expanded the authorities. We expanded the interpretation. Now all of that counter-narcotics money can be used for what you all thought about as counter-narcotics, but we define counter-narcotics as a direct contributor to terrorism. It's a whole big bag of money now. We're tying that bag of money in with the goals and objectives that are being identified by U.S. SOCOM. Commander SOCOM wants to get teams into Colombia. Okay, we'll send them down there with counter-narcotics money. You want to get more people into Afghanistan to start doing certain types of things under the guise of narcotics? We got the money over here. We'll move it over there. All of that leverage, humanitarian activity funds, do the same thing. Put the civil affairs people where we want them so that we can drive the war rather than just sitting back waiting for embassies to say, we'd like for you to send four guys into our country to dig wells. No, we're going to them now. You don't need wells in your country, but we're coming anyway. So we have boots on the ground. We start developing infrastructure and contacts. That's the way SOLIC is looking at the problem. Obviously, since we're getting away with it, the senior leadership is supporting us. They know what we're doing, and the guidance is press on. That's the view from the Pentagon. Does anybody have any questions?
The war on terrorism will soon become whatever they want to define it as, because they are on a hunt for evil, and maybe underlying that belief is a belief that there is just a finite amount of evil in the world, and they can eliminate it. I'm back up at the symposium, and suddenly a smiling 60s-looking psychedelic face appears. It's part of John Ringgruber's presentation. He's director of the technology program for Solik. They're developing a technology to recognize evil. Just from the stress in the muscles of the face, each layer a different color, a deceptive smile exposed.
We need to detect human physiological conditions that are indicative of stress related to illegal activity. We need to know when somebody's lying. We expect that this kind of capability, when developed, will be banned during political campaigns.
But I'm thinking, why not use it to root out evil at home? Would that be too intrusive? I mean, if they can use our voice and email, and now our thoughts, and the public at least, before Homeland Security, could use the Presidential and Federal Records Act and the very important Freedom of Information Act to find out what their government was doing on their behalf. Because the theory had been that a democracy works best with a well-informed public. Then why should the people not have a tool to read the minds of officials that we, the people, put our trust in? Back on the exhibition floor, David Port, who's been selling high-powered binoculars and helping me spot the hottest technology, tells me about a gun.
This new weapon over here is an amazing, amazing weapon. It fires, I believe, three different ballistics. It lasers, it programs each individual bullet to explode at a certain range. So he lasers on his target, it programs the bullet, it explodes over top. And it devastates everything in like a 9-meter circle. It's gone out of one single bullet. Amazing. All of what you see here is the reason why we will never lose any war anywhere.
We'll just go bankrupt.
Well, that could be, yes.
Because this stuff is expensive, right?
It is fairly expensive. Just like any new technology, you know, it's going to take years for it to be used in volumes that drive the cost of manufacturing down. Not unlike Henry Ford's problem when he first started the automobile.
I mean, that means we have to either, like, get into a lot of wars or export a lot of guns.
I'm not an advocate of war, but maybe it's just time to take a look at how we do spend all of our billions and billions of dollars of tax money that we get.
I wish David all the best and hope that his long-range, gyro-stabilized night vision binoculars, now selling to the government at about $4,000 a pop, does well. Maybe Solik trains 500 snipers, equips them with David's binoculars, scatters them in the mountains of Afghanistan, and one of them picks off Bin Laden as he emerges from his cave. But somehow I don't think this will happen. And I kind of have the feeling that David knows that too. It's much bigger than one man. And nobody can know where the war to root out evil will end. This is Eddie Becker reporting for Peace Watch.
Peace Watch had the honor of speaking with noted scholar, writer, and poet Haki Matubuti this week about the impending invasion into Iraq, as well as his latest book, Tough Notes, A Healing Call for Creating Exceptional Black Men. Matubuti is the founder of Third World Press, one of the oldest African-American publishing companies in the U.S. He's been touring colleges and universities, encouraging young people to develop their own voice around such issues.
One of the real problems in many families today is that the value systems all too often are going in two different directions, mm-hmm. Whereas parents have specific values, and the streets where the child, young men and women are a part of, well, certainly 8-9 hours a day, which includes school, have a different set of values. And so in terms of trying to get on the same track and most certainly to discuss these very important points, it would be good that the parent as well as the young man or woman are read along with them.
And that helps them to sort of share their values, and the parent can pick up on the values that the child may be formulating or the youngster may be formulating that is incongruent with perhaps the parent's set of values that they're trying to teach. What do you think is the message? What is the intended message for, let's start with the young African-American man that's picking up this book?
Well, there are many messages, obviously, but I think that the major point is that we have to begin very early to formulate a way of life that is constructive and in concert with the best in the world. And I wrote the book because my love for young people has a real history. my own and that of black struggle in America. I'm a product of the 60s, and I would never apologize for the 60s because the 60s not only changed America, but changed the world for the best. So my love for young people has guided my writing, my work, and life over the last 35 years or so, 39 years, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I have worked here in Chicago and building independent black institutions. We have two schools and publishing company, and I'm on the faculty at Chicago State University, where we have the Glenn and Brooks Center for Creative Literature and Black Writing. And so what I do, and I try to do in most of my work, is to not only survey this tremendous struggle that we are part of in this country, but I realize that what is missing in the young lives of most of our young people is an informed introduction to the world. Mm-hmm. And most certainly, say something as simple or as important as the arts. Most young people have not been properly introduced to the developmental properties of art.
The day and age that we live in now, with the prospect of a war with Iraq looming on the horizons, millions rallied this past weekend to oppose a war against Iraq. Some will call it an invasion into Iraq. What is your perspective? Have you carved out a position with regard to whether the Bush administration's war agenda is an appropriate one or not?
I do not think it's an appropriate one. I think that it's ill-informed, and I think that it's personal in many ways. And I feel that the blowback effect on the United States will be tremendous if this war emerges. Representative Ron Paul of Texas, who's a Republican, introduced legislation to recall the War Powers Act early part of this month. I don't know how far it's going to go.
Interestingly enough, Congressman Rangel and Congressman John Conyers have reintroduced a bill calling for bringing back the draft, the military draft in this country. And I know that you are a veteran and you write in your book about how September 11th had an impact on you personally.
Right.
What are your thoughts about recalling the draft?
Well, I think it's a good tactic in terms of moving the conversation, at least allowing people to really look at it a different way, because they are principally right that poor people fight wars. But on the other side of it, that rich people, whether the draft is instituted or not, are still able to stay out of wars. In terms of the conversation, it's fine. But what I would rather see really instituted, and that has a greater possibility, is a two-year service to the United States. It doesn't matter whether it's in the armed forces or Peace Corps or AmeriCorps. I think that the young people coming out of high school who are really not sure what they want to do, they should all give at least 2 years in the service of the country.
I guess this whole recalling of the draft makes me a little bit nervous, because I see where this particular Congress that you alluded to earlier has not really been all that successful in terms of being able to pass certain legislation. I'm not necessarily that comforted by that myself. I was wondering if you have any of those concerns.
Well, yes, I share those concerns. I think that the Democratic Party has acted rather cowardly in the face of Republican opposition, not only in terms of signing on to President Bush's tax proposal and legislation, but also in terms of pushing their own program, or pushing a program that would allow some deep conversation around the country. They really need to try to get their act together. I don't think that that's going to happen unless they begin to really listen to our prominent and not so prominent black leadership, Latino leadership, and Asian leadership. I think there is a growing grassroots local leadership all across this country.
In this particular day and age, would some African-American men join the military in order to grab a better chance at life? What might you say to a black soldier who finds him or herself on the way to Baghdad at this time to fight a war against the people of Iraq?
That's a very good question. There are very few options once you're in the military. When I first went in 1960, I only went in because that was the only option that was available. Because during that period, we were just coming out of and just still fighting our way out of apartheid America. And so the options, most certainly educational options for a poor boy coming off the Lower East Side of Detroit, Michigan, and the West Side of Chicago were few. In fact, I was on the way to basic training. I was reading a book by Paul Robeson,
mm-hmm.
Here I Stand. And it was three black men and about 187 white men in the buses going to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. And when I was coming off the bus, I had Paul Robeson's book in my hand, and Paul Robeson's big, black, magnificent face was on the book, and this drill sergeant, middle-aged, about 35, 40-year-old drill sergeant, saw the book and snatched it out of my hand and barked in my face, "What's your Negro mind doing reading that black communist?" That was the first time I heard a double negative used so creatively. But at the same time, I was frightened because here I was alone in the middle of Missouri, and this man snatched my book and said, told all the recruits, you know, to say, all you women up against the bus. Now, of course, there weren't any women there, but we were in the age of sexism also. Mm-hmm. And he held my book over his head, and he commenced to tear the pages out of the book and gave a page to each of the recruits and told them to use it for toilet paper. Mm. And so as I stood there that morning, you know, cold and in deep fear, wondering what my options were, I was also reading a book by a very important novelist by the name of John Oliver Killens. And the title of that book was And Then We Heard the Thunder, which is about black men and Europe's war on the world number two, commonly known as World War II. And what I learned from John Killens is that when you're outnumbered like that, what you need to do is think about options, but most certainly keep your mouth shut. My point is that once you're in the military, you have very few options other than to take orders. Mm-hmm. And these orders, in many cases, may indeed be against the best interests of you, or the soldier, or Marine, or sailor, or airman, or woman, personally, but you have very few options, you see. Mm-hmm. And once you sign the paper, it's very difficult for you to get out of it. Now, I went into the military, and I think that the military, for me, it helped a great deal. I mean, I was a poor boy who didn't receive his first suit until his mother's funeral. You see, grew up, you know, very poor. And so when I went into the military, it was the first time I ate three meals a day, first time I had my own bed, first time I had a regular salary coming in each month. So that's why many young black, poor black, white, Latino, go into the military, mm-hmm. you see. Mm-hmm. The only thing I could tell these young brothers is to try to find a community in the military, a community of like-minded soldiers and Marines, or whatever the case may be, and try to bond and trying to become the type of buddies in a war situation that will help you stay alive.
Sane, sobering advice. The media is making a concerted effort to characterize anyone speaking out against this particular war as enemies of the U.S. and anti-American. As a writer, as a poet, how do you encourage young students to take a moral stance, or do you encourage young students to take a moral stance against this war?
Oh, absolutely. Well, one of the real problems is I think that the mass media has really betrayed its role, its mission, that for the most part, you do not get any kind of serious analysis of the other side. There's a large, very large anti-war movement. Mm-hmm. You have to really look for them. I mean, go to the library and begin to try to find other material and other voices. Pacifica Radio has been in the forefront for many years, and so I would strongly suggest they continue to listen to Pacifica. The only people who come out ahead in terms of this war situation are people who are involved in the making of armaments. Mm-hmm. And most certainly going into Iraq, a part of this whole equation is oil, you see. And that's one of the underlying questions that everybody's denying in many cases, but it's about oil. The key test is they're going into Iraq rather than North Korea.
Final question. You've written about Malcolm X.
Right.
Any thoughts or reflections you
care
to share with us at this time?
Malcolm X is one of the reasons I'm here. He, El Hajj Malik al-Shabazz, helped to inform my voice. Malcolm X was the first black man that I saw, read, listened to, who spoke truth to power. Not only in terms of truth to power in terms of, you know, the ruling elite of this country, but also the ruling elite within the context of the black community, and most certainly in his own camp, which cost him his life. And so I have great respect for Malcolm X. I always say he was one of my mentors, even though I never met him. But most certainly his voice, his message, his words, and his person of how he lived as a man has informed me tremendously.
How might his voice weigh in on this question of war against Iraq were he here today?
I would think that he would be critical of the war itself. At the same time, I think that he would be critical of the dictatorial policies of some of the Arab states, which are, in many cases, Islamic, but are ruled by corrupt monarchs or corrupt dictators. And I'm sure that Malcolm, if he was alive today, would be speaking out against that existence as well as this country rush into war.
Dr. Haki Matubuti, founder of Third World Press and author of Tough Notes, A Healing Call for Creating Exceptional Black Men. From the popular album of the 70s, Rise, Vision, Coming by Nation and Dr. Haki Matubuti, here's an excerpt from the title selection.
We are what we are now.
Think Jim, Gulf War, IBM, or GM, the way you talk about industrializing Africa. If they took the water faucet from him, he'd die water free. Thank him, Dow Chemical or the Pentagon, the way they talk about arming Africa. But well, we gonna need more than wine bottles, promises, and ray gun dreaming. Thank him, Harvard or MIT, the way they talk about educating Africa. Couldn't even teach a daycare center if it was already taught. We are what we are going to be.
We are what we are going to be.
Come in, Sam. Come in, Willie. Come in, Mabel. Come in, Jesus, Melinda, Pepper. Now you different. Come in, Rise. Rise. Come in, talking about doing it yourself, huh? About institutionalizing your thoughts, your actions. Come in, Rise. To claim the tradition and collective culture of your world. Come in, Rise. Rise, Junebug. Beat evil back to the cold, Zimbabwe. Expose the enemy for Lima. You gon' do it, Angola. Rise. Rise. Now you different blood, new, strong, stronger than storm, bigger, better than a barefooted Negro in $50 shoes. Come and run and call you swift, call you fast.
A young Dr. Haki Matubuti. Finally tonight, producers Michael Woodson, Mike McGuire, Kevin White of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston present the Poets for Peace, Cool B, Tiva, and Lyric. With lush beats by DJ Leon, 808, and Matador, the Poets for Peace speak truth to power and question the wisdom of an administration that they say overlooks domestic needs for the hunt for new oil sources.
Polly. Tricksters, a wicked mixture of rhetoric and gun smoke, like John Wayne, Matt Dillon, blood spilling, human killing. For the right to die in peace. Colin Powell howls an ultimatum, a White House conundrum. His panic searches out, seeking bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, nuclear weapons, ill-stepping polytricksters. Imminence at will, spring returns our survival, kites are on the air.
Endless war, sending the children of the poor, but it's the crap for peace that's been stirring up the streets. It's been stirring up the streets.
I hear sound bites. These news highlights and subliminal messages have me thinking that I should want to fight. Well, I do, but most of the time I want to fight against you. These yellow pages of propaganda bleed red, and I know that it's blood money, so I don't believe everything that's said. Not at all. Not at all. Not at all.
All the hatred and greed has only given us the need for more love seed. For more love seed so all the people can see. So all of we can see. How we really gonna get free. How we really gonna get free. How we really gonna get free. We got worldwide unity.
We got worldwide unity, worldwide unity.
Now can't you see as these bombs flash in the middle of the night, as those people sit there in fright, realize that the situation is not really tight, understand that it's a marketing campaign, millions of dollars based upon pain, and it flows just like a river, and as that sea spreads and divides, they try to keep me there, so I could be surrounded and drowned in those lies, fallacies. History is written by the conquerors, imperialistic, colonialism, it all goes down, and then you change the adjective so it kind of changes. But it's the same.
In rivers of freedom's cries.
Always the same.
Our future lies.
Always the same.
In rivers of freedom's cries.
Always the same. Good morning, revolution. Good morning, revolution. The boss heard we was chumming around. Heard that we was spreading messages all over town. Good morning, revolution. They don't like it when you come knocking upon my door, calling me up at 4 a.m, telling me about how they just shot down someone. Someone brown, someone black, someone yellow, someone blue, someone white. Just like you, revolution, just like you. My boss don't like us chilling, hanging around.
At all. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they say we should tie an American flag around our eyes for a little while.
Picture perfect pans of the scenery. Footprints left in the mud and the greenery, bringing me closer to a war zone. Microphone static, tragic episodes of poets in the jungle who stumbles, gets their head blowed off. You're lost in this life, you got to pay the cost. Frost on my breath, my soul takes a journey. These writers try to fight me, devils try to burn me with fire, shadows all around me, blocking out the sun. My thoughts light as feathers, these Uzis weigh a ton. Another one drops in the grave, a brighter day sways in my way. I blink, I'm tripping, slipping into darkness, heartless homicides. I ride for the pleasure, but the pain coincides. Divide all the teardrops I've cried. I won't lie, I'm a soldier rolling like a boulder as the world grows colder and colder. And colder, and colder.
Ellos dicen que es por nuestra protección. And they say for our safety. And they say for our safety, immigrants can be detained with no charges. And they say for our safety, they can now be sentenced to death in a secret courtroom with hidden evidence. For our safety. Our homes can now be searched by the laws with no probable cause. For our safety, for our safety.
The Poets for Peace, performing at Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Thanks to Jackson Allers for production assistance. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Reem Kathuda, and Keith Chalgion. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support this type of programming, and we wish you would, we urge you to visit pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening. Thank you.